Welcome to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world. This is bonus episode 25, The Webs of Commerce, How Slavery Bound the Atlantic Littoral. While my podcast narrative focuses on the intertwined syncretic history of New York and Quebec, my passions extend beyond this scope to encapsulate the wider Atlantic world from 1600 to 1815. The Caribbean and Atlantic Littoral is a crucial extension to my narrative. Barbados, Jamaica, and Saint-Domingue are great jumping-off points to understand the Anglo and French slave societies in the West Indies, along with their connections to mainland North America, Africa, and Europe. At one time, the entire Caribbean was Spanish-controlled for a short period, but sparsely settled in many places. The English inroads developed in the outer regions during times of Spanish commitment in Europe, over a 150-year period. The impact of Hispanic culture on these peripheral areas isn't long-lasting, and instead English, French, and Dutch became the dominant Creole-based languages in places like Jamaica, on the western third of Hispaniola, in the Lesser Antilles, on the ABC Desert Islands, and also on the Virgin Islands. The English and Dutch derived syncretic cultures that took hold in places like Jamaica, Barbados, St. Martin, St. Kitts, and Curaçao have a very intertwined history with their Latin, French, Spanish, and to a lesser extent Portuguese counterparts. Barbados represents the early native and indentured servitude period, while presenting a model of transition to African slavery. While Jamaica will demonstrate how this system forced unique societal compromises and marks the end of slavery in the British Empire. The island initially eclipses Jamaica because of the latter being exposed to Spanish invasion, but Jamaica will see its potential fulfilled. Its landmass size and geography made it better suited to reproduce the Dutch-acquired plantation system developed on Barbados, but scaled up to a grand size on the island. The Maroon Wars, Tacky's Revolt, and finally Sharpe's Revolt of 1831 all coalesced with the drastically changing international market for sugar to create an atmosphere in 1833 that led to relatively peaceful abolition. The labor would be replaced in many areas by Southeast Asian subjects of the British Empire, and slave owners received a scaled compensation from government funds. The English Civil War and Cromwell's determination to bolster England's Caribbean presence in Jamaica led to the need for immediate labor. His conquest of Ireland had produced a significant amount of prisoners, and most of these were initially sent to Caribbean islands like Barbados, St. Kitts, Montserrat, and Antigua, but they were soon diverted north to the Virginia tidal zones. Deemed too rebellious in concert with the rapidly growing African slave population on the Caribbean islands, the indentured servants almost toppled the Virginian colonial government in collusion with the enslaved African population near Jamestown. This is where the story is linked once again to the Atlantic Littoral, and Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia finds its genesis. Bacon's Rebellion is instrumental in transforming colonial settlement policy toward incorporating the poor white smallholders and newly freed indentured servants. It is an intentional social engineering project to uphold an economic system trending toward chattel slavery. Race was fluid in the frontier buffer zones that incubated the rebellion. It was more about class and economics. The entire episode is juxtaposed against the Native American threat to those who balance their lives on the syncretic frontier, regardless of skin color. We see the definitions of race tightening in later years, but that's hindsight and ahistorical for the Atlantic Basin Littoral during this time period. The rebellion's leaders get the stick, but the rest of its supporters receive the carrot and are brought into the fold. A slow realization crept in that these others that were so recently conquered and enslaved by war would have to be brought within the colonial project overseas. Even relying upon a population of indentured servants who signed a contract after their world was obliterated and subdued would prove to be a dangerous proposition without giving them the ability to rise in New World society. Bacon's Rebellion had signaled an end to Irish and Scottish indentured servitude and the start of wide-scale importation of Africans to take their place. English Jamaica's special relationship with Maroonage started early, a mere 3 years after the English had successfully conquered the island in 1655. They still faced considerable resistance from Spanish colonists, their slaves, and reinforcements from the Mexican mainland. Ensconced in the mountainous interior of the island, these Spanish holdouts still raided English settlements and plantations, while severely impacting trade routes and communication lines. The island of Tortuga, north of Haiti, happened to contain bands of pirates that survived by raiding Spanish shipping, and lived in a gray zone at the edge of imperial ambitions. These hardy bands of syncretic warriors were adept at carefully planned lightning raids and possessed the skills needed to track down and surprise the Spanish holdouts in the mountains. Starting in 1657, the buccaneers captured most of the Spanish rebel leadership and forced the rest to flee. But a significant population of formerly enslaved Africans were left in the mountains. These Cimarrones, or wild people, would become known by the anglicized term Maroon, and continue to fight for more than 75 years against the planter military garrison community of English Jamaica. These free African communities would outlast the pirates, who stayed on for several prosperous decades, headquartered at Port Royal. The 1692 earthquake would signal the end to their previous amicable relationship with the island, as the island's leadership and military command could no longer properly channel their energies or restrain them in peacetime. The Maroons' skillful guerrilla combat and their dense, naturally fortified hidden villages had forced Jamaican authorities to grudgingly acknowledge their freedoms in exchange for their cooperation with the slave regime. They would now have to employ their considerable survival skills toward tracking down and returning any escaped slaves, but their communities were free to grow. Free blacks, Hispanics, and Jews made up one-third of Spanish Town's population by the start of the 18th century. The Jewish residents were mostly descendants of those who had fled the Inquisition and sought out Spanish-controlled Jamaica as an out-of-the-way place to start anew. Each of these groups were offered membership in the island's militia. From 1700 to 1760, more than 400,000 African slaves were imported through Kingston, Jamaica. On average, during this time period, one could find 100,000 souls toiling on the plantations and manning the industry needed to produce products like rum on any given day. An interesting peek into the syncretic world of the Atlantic Basin, a major lieutenant in the 1760 slave revolt on Jamaica used to frequent the British slaving factory at Cape Coast Castle. He came to sell slaves and became acquainted with the agent in charge of the slaving enterprise, but was eventually captured and sold into slavery himself. When this warrior chief arrived in Jamaica, he soon realized his old friend owned a plantation nearby. The British agent hosted his old business partner with honorific dinners until he passed away. Another fascinating tidbit that links Tacky's revolt back to African conflicts is the fact that the leader is an Akan war chief who boasts of selling his defeated opponents into slavery until this happens to him. It's also intertwined with the early Maroon Wars and the concept of this autonomous free black community whose agreement with the state is predicated on their participation in returning runaway slaves. It presents complex and nuanced angles that must be pursued through a variety of lenses. Historian Vincent Brown proposes an interesting lens through which to interpret slave revolts as an extension or continuation of an African-based conflict. In terms of the major revolts up until 1789, all were led by former aristocrats and warriors well-versed in the brutal wars of enslavement that raged across the continent. It refocuses one upon true breadth of the Atlantic Basin and links the African wars directly into the New World dynamic. Though limited in scope compared to the large-scale conflagrations consuming Africa, Caribbean slave revolts should be viewed as a form of warfare. Brown argues that even if we find this a difficult leap to make, the opposing parties certainly viewed their conflict through a military framework. The Royal Navy's Jamaican station was staffed by many enslaved Akan Africans by the start of the 18th century. This group made up almost one-third of the entire manpower pool of the local fleet. Historian Vincent Brown writes, "Black people performed much of this basic labor on the station. A report of 1748 listed 53 caulkers, 2 sawyers, 6 smiths, and 51 laborers, all paid 5 shillings a day. Alongside these were 14 more black laborers and 7 boat crewmen earning less than 2 shillings a day, as well as 10 King's Negroes, slaves owned by the Navy. The issue was that when the fleet returned home on rotation, enslaved Africans were left in the Caribbean. Those in bondage found themselves usually working some sort of overseer role on a plantation. They might be higher up the social ladder, but they were still enslaved. This caused many who served Britain to harbor deeply held feelings of betrayal. West Indies planters of either side during the Seven Years' War didn't truly want to conquer and incorporate neighboring sugar islands. This would depress prices. The real objective was to trash plantation infrastructure, destroy military defenses, and seize the island's enslaved population. this bounty of human chattel would then be removed to the opposing side's islands and help alleviate the interruptions in the overall transatlantic trade. This attitude helps explain the head-spinning amount of changes through the Napoleonic era. If you could hand back your enemy a destroyed and bankrupt land, you've now passed that financial problem and a restive population along. Historian Vincent Brown offers an interesting theory on how British conquests of the French Antilles played into this propensity for seizing and removing the conquered enslaved population. French militia on Martinique and Guadeloupe employed many slaves trained in the art of war and promised their freedom if they participated in the struggle against the British. During the 1759 invasion of Guadeloupe, French royal units retreated to the mountains and relied on their trained slaves to hold important geographic passes. British soldiers suffered terribly from vicious insurgent activity for a month. This included white women slaveholders leading their African militia into battle as well. These African enslaved militiamen were captured, and many ended up sold into slavery, even though they had supposedly secured their freedom by fighting for the French. These re-enslaved had both cultural and personal grievances they would bring to their new homeland. Being trained in guerrilla warfare and boiling over with hatred for the British, many of the captives would find their way to Jamaica. On the islands, much of the planter class became absentee landowners by the start of the 1700s. Earlier on, the planter class tended to be anyone who was lucky enough to survive a few years on the island and get out, but large-scale capital outlays began to be required. The volatile economic market of commodity crops also saw many estates being lost to bankruptcy or consolidated under a dwindling number of large planters. Jennifer Palmer's book, Intimate Bonds, anchors the two sides of the Atlantic Basin together by weaving a story of Saint-Domingue and my own familial city of La Rochelle. While I've studied the city's connections with Nouvelle-France, and as the gateway for my own ancestors' departure, I wasn't aware of its unique legal status as applied to slavery. After seizure by forces under the command of Cardinal Richelieu, La Rochelle was put under the jurisdiction of the Parlement of Paris. In an attempt to deny the existence of enslaved peoples within the Kingdom of France, the Parlement refused to register the first series of laws restraining slavery. These series of attempts to regulate and banish the practice in the first half of the 18th century happened to coincide with the rise of Saint-Domingue. The connection between La Rochelle and Saint-Domingue was born. Here was a place where slave owners could bring their chattel and not have to worry about interference from the French crown. The port became the entrepot of not humans, but the goods produced by them, driven in a large part by the help of the Huguenot diaspora in the French Antilles. This gray legal zone between property and human begins to widen for those enslaved after the end of the Seven Years' War. The French king's free soil guardian role had given way to the concept of personal property in the form of human chattel by the start of the 18th century. The Code Noir classified slaves as meubles, or movable property. This classification gave the French royal crown a way out of a tricky situation. Property exchange of this sort was not under royal purview. While slavery was sanctioned in the Antilles, slave owners were just passing through French shores with their property. This could not be interfered with. The Edict of 1716 set requirements that slave owners must seek permission from the French Admiralty before departure and complete registration of their human chattel upon arrival in the metropole. Royal authorities only allowed slaves permission to enter mainland France if seeking a Catholic education, learning a trade, or serving their master as a domestic for a year or less. Absentee ownership had now become the norm as the early generations retired back to the metropole and spread their wealth through familial connections. Agents were assigned to oversee a plantation's functions, and this was usually sublet to a white overseer. The trusted African commandeurs and personal livery of the original generation of planters assumed the role of informant through letter, constantly outmaneuvering the local agents and their white managers. By the 1770s, even this closely linked slave hierarchy was disappearing. Now the agent and their managers began to take the upper hand. The third generation of absentee owners cared little. As long as the lever flowed into their accounts, the non-existent personal investment threw open the door to unmitigated horrors. The Code Noir was finally amended in 1784, and it was aimed at reeling in the abusive attitudes and illegal use of absentee ownership property by white managers. The overhaul even provided concrete judicial avenues and clear penalties, including removal for any manager found guilty. Planters located on the island teamed up with other agents and lawyers of the absentee planter's interest. The reforms were halted and then diluted. Probably the last chance to head off the revolt had been lost to the greed of the absentee land-owning bureaucrats. I keep looking for that one wow factor to explain how the 1760 Jamaican slave revolt failed and why the 1789 Haitian revolt on Saint-Domingue succeeded. Instead, I think a bunch of subtle differences stack up and outside environmental influences play a huge role. Imagine Tacky's revolt occurs in the midst of the British Civil War, having exhausted the treasury. I'm not spotting the great differences in the cruelty levels of plantation overseers and drivers or racial hierarchies that develop. A point for further study is the concept of Jamaica's militarized garrison structure and the Royal Navy's permanent presence, and whether a similar militarized society could have made a difference on Saint-Domingue. This is where disease exposure and immunity come into play. The decimation of foreign French forces by mosquito-borne illness occurs every time a new shipment of men and material arrive from Europe. I wanted to highlight two further revolts during the 18th century in the Caribbean Basin and their links to recently enslaved African war captives. Cato's slave rebellion that engulfed South Carolina in 1739 was partly caused by the suppression of Catholicism amongst the newly arrived evangelized African POWs from Angola. The rebellion date coincides with the Feast of the Virgin Mary, and the slaves hoped to fight their way to the Spanish in Florida in order to receive their freedom in exchange for militia service at St. Augustine. For anyone lucky enough to visit the U.S. Virgin Islands, most are overwhelmed by the unparalleled natural beauty and stunning syncretic culture, but bypass the smallest of three U.S.-controlled islands. St. John was Danish for a large part of its history, importing slaves directly from their station outside of modern Accra. In 1733, a large slave revolt convulsed the island for almost half the year, until Danish authorities allowed French soldiers from Martinique to help put down the revolt. The uprising was again led by Akan warriors and is seen as a prequel to Tacky's revolt. It's clear that not only goods and peoples flowed around the Atlantic basin, but also history and legends that inspired and intermingled to form parallel narratives. Denmark would finally free its slave population in 1848. Emancipation arrives on the British Islands in 1833, on the French Islands in 1848, and on the Dutch Islands in 1863. The sale to the U.S. in 1917 comes with a price tag of $25 million for the three islands, but also with U.S. recognition of Danish claims to Greenland. For almost 200 years in the New World, the system of labor was staffed by religious enemies of the early modern European states. This is also linked to a lesser extent to the nationalism that was emerging tied to religious affiliation. Whether it was native enslavement by the Spanish until large-scale conversions occurred, or the expulsion of the Jews, the French vis-à-vis the Huguenots, or the early English attitudes toward the indentured servitude of the Irish and Scottish. The otherness is first experimented with and implemented by these states through a religious lens. It then morphs toward a more static racial boundary by the start of the 18th century. This is highly correlated to the vicious religious wars born out of the Reformation and the need to compete with opposing powers in the New World by sending groups of colonists to lay claim. This societal divide then becomes exacerbated as religious motivations merge with those of the nation-state and are supported by the profits of African slavery on both sides of the Atlantic Basin. Thanks for listening to New York, Quebec, and the Water Route to the Center of the World. Remember to follow the show and leave me a review.